Hello, world, and welcome to John Richardson and the Future Notes, the Book of Revelations. This is episode 6. I am joined, as ever, by Ed Gillespie.
Aloha.
And Mark Stevenson. With a cold. That's Klingon.
If you like.
I don't really. I've never seen an episode. I was taken to watch Star Trek the movie by my mother for my birthday when I was about 8 years old. I fell asleep and I've had a grudge against the entire franchise ever since.
Oh my God, this is where we bifurcate. I was taken to see it at about, well, you couldn't have been 8 years old. You must have been younger because it came out in 1978, I think.
The one with the whales in.
Oh,
is
no.
Journey Home or something?
Yeah, that one. That one's terrible. The original Star Trek the Motion Picture I remember seeing, and it was one of the most transformative moments of my life.
It would be the first thing we've bifurcated on, to be fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, only a few weeks ago, we bifurcated on the word bifurcate, which you used in conversation, and I pretended I knew, and I had to Google after we spoke to find out what it meant. Bifurcating all over the place.
Well, that's one step up on Googling pliers.
Yes. Well, let's come on to the last week's podcast. We've had some exceptionally kind feedback. A lot of people really enjoyed that episode. So Peter says on Twitter, well done, Wales. I was unaware of the Future Generations Wellbeing Act until this episode. Why hasn't England got one? Or more to the point, why doesn't everyone have one? Jenny says, not living in the UK, I'd never heard of the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. It's so simple in its core, force governments to deliver actual results to protect future wellbeings instead of just making plans. Google's moving to Wales, between asterisks, you know, as if it's a thing she's doing.
Does she mean that she's Googling how to move to Wales, or is she telling us that Google is moving its international headquarters to Wales?
I think the former.
Yeah, there's no apostrophe there.
Right.
But giving the state of grammar in the, you want to do an episode on the future of grammar, mate. And Annie, who emailed in our first series, has stayed with us. That's always reassuring, doesn't it? The lovely Anne. I'm guessing one of us described her as the lovely Anne, because that's a very vain way of signing off your email. So I think we must have described her as the lovely Anne. But she said, I enjoyed The Future Generations, enjoyed hearing frequent references to Donella Meadows, but although the frustration of hearing quotes from the mid-80s about a topic that we haven't really advanced on. But she said, since you all seem to enjoy a good quote, here's one Donella quoted in her own writing. If you don't change the direction you are going in, you are likely to end up where you're heading. Mm. What do you think of that?
Well, it's variously attributed to all sorts of people. Some people think it's an old Chinese proverb. Some people said that Einstein said it. It's kind of one of those quotes that sort of flits around and gets attributed to all sorts of people, and you can use as you like, really.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Well, Anne won't be with a series 4 then. What did you make of that? I think she's got her facts wrong. Okay, yeah. Bye, Anne. Thanks for listening.
I wanted you to read the one from David Kelly, just because he's from County Down. In Northern
yes,
Ireland.
Well, I was going to come on to David Kelly because, well, you've had a particular experience this week, haven't you? We're in a WhatsApp group. For those of you who think we're like just nerdy guys, we've got WhatsApp. Sometimes we put GIFs on it, you know, suck on that. David Kelly from Coyndy Down wants me to do a Northern Irish accent there. Coyndy Down.
That's not bad. It's been a while. Well, we haven't had accents really for at least a series and a half. Are they making a comeback?
I read the news. I see the way accents are going. I see what's happening to guys like me who just want to have a little bit of fun and do a funny voice. I see what happens. But as far as I'm concerned, no bad can come of doing a Northern Irish accent. And I look forward to seeing anyone who disagrees at my gig at Belfast Waterfront next year. Davey from Coyndy Down, Northern Irish accent would be fun. Are you aware that Northern Ireland has about 1,000 different accents? But I think anyone outside Northern Ireland only hears one, or so folk tell me. That's a cross there between my Auntie Pam and Eamon Holmes, if you want to know the research I did there. But David suggests an episode on aliens. He goes back to our episode on religion. He says, keep reading, don't mock me for these views. But he writes eloquently and passionately about the idea that we had visitors to this planet from a more technologically advanced society who planted religion, would you say? Is that the sort of gist of the email? Religion was planted as a way of teaching us how to look after our bodies. He says fasting is mentioned in many religions' texts, and fasting, we now understand, with 21st century medicine is key to looking after your body. Meditation, he says, meditation and prayer is seen as a religious thing, but is actually, we now understand, a very good way of looking after our mental health. What have you made of that?
Well, it was really weird because I'd literally woken up that morning with the first thought in my head going, we should do an episode on the future of aliens. Then I read that email that morning. Then my brother sent me an amazing video clip, which was essentially arguing that we're already surrounded by 8 million aliens on the planet here with all our fellow species. And then I was talking to a mate of mine, James, who actually works for NASA, on Sunday, and he goes, oh, you know, well, you should interview Seth Shostak, you know, from SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. He's their chief astronomer. And then it turns out Mark's already been on his show.
Yeah. Seth's interviewed me, so maybe we should interview him.
I'm up for an episode, especially now I realise we have a guest other than David Icke. That was my only sort of concern. I'm more than up for a chat about aliens. Let's definitely do that.
We're going to make you watch Star Trek as research in advance, John.
Yeah, well, you're going to need some sort of psychotherapist on hand. My mum listens to this podcast, so she will already be questioning the decision she made back then. But
I'm sure she's questioned many decisions, isn't she, John?
Very nice. Wonderful. So this barbing at each other and this tension speaks to today's topic, which is... Well, we're not sure how to, at this point, we've conducted our interview. We're not sure how to label it because it was originally the future of war. But it's become a different kind of conversation, hasn't it?
Mm. I think what's so great about it is that it kind of, it's an interview with a very senior ranking military officer, and the sort of level of nuance and systems thinking, understanding and interplay of society and technology and all that he brings to it. We all found it quite surprising, I think.
Yeah, I had this mental image, you know, after you'd been at TED Countdown in Edinburgh with the general, I had a sort of image of him sort of working the room with you on his arm, like a sort of blushing debutante. and then when we started recording, when I was listening back to the recording, I was like, wow, Mark's really got his serious voice on for this one, which kind of hints at the gravitas of the whole discussion.
Yes. We were on our best behavior, weren't we? Don't embarrass me in front of my new friends was the vibe. So for those of you who are fans of Systems Chat, stay tuned. And just those of you who've been with our podcast from the beginning, who started to pick up on the seeds dropped by Mark a little while ago, oh, I've got some big news, I'm not allowed to talk about it, that slowly morphed into, look, there's some stuff going on with the military, I can't talk about it. And if you, like me, thought... Mark's having a breakdown and he's trying to pretend that he's going into the army, you'll be as relieved as Ed and I were to find out that he does have a friend in the military. They have been working on very important things and you are about to hear about them. So enjoy the interview. We will be back on the other side with a confession from a listener and some updates on what it is that you do while you're listening to the podcast. But I will hand you now to Mark Stevenson, who will introduce our guest for today's chat.
It is my enormous pleasure to welcome to the podcast, I think, the highest ranking military officer we've ever had on the podcast. Indeed, the only military officer we've ever had on the podcast. The wonderful Lieutenant General Richard Nugie, CB, CVO, CBE. And it's fair to say you're kind of towards the end of your military career, but towards the end of that, you became Chief of Defence People at the Ministry of Defence, which is essentially... Director of HR for the entire armed forces. You're absolutely replete with medals and gongs, but you started off as an anthropologist, which I find interesting. I think we'll come to that later. You do seem to come from quite the establishment stock, it seems. Dad was a very senior and well-noted barrister. You've got a number of siblings. One of them is already a sir, who is also a barrister. Your mum, I found out this week, was one of the code breakers at Bletchley Park. So it's quite a heritage, and I think probably talks to why you're quite the inventive character that I've come to know. I met Richard when he was appointed to basically be the lead on climate change and sustainability for the Ministry of Defence. And he asked me to be on an advisory board, of which I was the weirdo. And then I became your massively well-paid, or shall we say completely unpaid, special advisor on helping you do that kind of stuff. So that's Richard. He is, I have to say, as a lifelong pacifist. He's one of the nicest people I've ever met. And even though, as I say, I'm a lifelong pacifist, I just the way that you talk and lead, I would probably follow you into battle. This is something very strange for me to say, but you have this incredible ability to see big problems, but also motivate people and phrase things in a way that gets them to do what that needs to be done. It's kind of an incredible lesson in leadership, sort of hanging out with you. So I'd like to welcome to the show, and we're going to talk about climate change and national security. So welcome, Richard.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I mean, I'm not sure how much of that I recognise, to be honest. And the other way of looking at my family is that my father's side of the family were immigrants from France, albeit now 300 years ago, and my mother's family were immigrants from Poland, albeit 100 and something years ago. So we've had at least three generations in the UK. But I'm quite proud of our sort of immigrant stock. Although, yes, you're right, we're quite establishment now.
You are. I mean, you know, you've got a CB. Your brother's a sir. I think was your dad a sir? Did he become a sir?
No, he was the senior chancery barrister in the country.
There you go.
My brother's in the Court of Appeal. Actually, he's a judge in the Court of Appeal at the moment.
Oh, good.
Which is quite good. And my other brother was one of my other brothers was in the Bank of England and ran Britain's foreign exchange, and then ran Hong Kong's Hong Kong's bank, the Hong Kong Monetary Authority for a bit.
Wow, you literally are, I think, the most establishment person we've had on. Would you agree, Gaps?
Yeah, well, I would ask straight away, knowing that you have people in finance and law, and they're topics we've covered previously on the podcast. Are they as climate proactive as you, or are you a bit of an outlier in the family?
I think I'm a bit of an outlier, actually. I mean, they're not anti it at all, but they're I don't think they've spent as much time thinking about it as I have. They've been quite busy doing other things, I suppose. But I think in that respect, I'm a bit of an outlier. But it's amazing because the whole family really are supportive of what I'm doing, including, you know, my sons and everybody else I seem to meet says, wow, great thing to do. As if it's a sort of badge of honour to do it, which isn't actually why I'm doing it at all.
So, I mean, we're going to come and talk about what you do, which is basically sort of the links between sort of climate change and national and international security. But before we get going, because I had to sort of learn this when I started working with you, when you talk about security and stability and peace, there are all these kind of definitional terms. So when you say national security, what do you actually mean as a soldier? What does that mean?
You know, I've spent my entire life since I was 16 when I joined or I signed up to the army. They kept me at school and then sent me to university. I've spent my entire sort of adult life doing what I think we're meant to do, which is defend the country and protect its citizens. And so national security is anything that actually threatens our citizens, anything that threatens either through, and usually that was sort of threats from other countries, or threats from terrorism, or threats from extremism, or something like that. And so national security is anything that threatens the nation. And I think And we have a history in this country of, and it's part of our mentality, I think, of having the channel and sea all around us, of trying to defeat those threats before they come across the channel. So we try and defeat at distance. We try and make sure that nothing horrible comes across the channel to us, because it's much, much, much more difficult if they get a foothold in our soil. So we're always looking to try and provide a sort of bubble of security around the UK and for UK citizens wherever they are in the world. That's what we're trying to do. Of course, we're not successful all the time, but that's what I think national security is.
So this brings me, I think, nicely onto what we're going to talk about, which is, you know, anything that threatens a nation. And it's fair to say, if we get into the section, which is, you know, how bad things are, how fucked are we? It's fair to say that most militaries and national security alliances around the world are very concerned about the changing climate. And they see some very real risks that it poses to global stability and conflict, and indeed their own ability to sort of operate as nations. So let's dig into that. I think the first thing is some very direct links, it turns out, between temperature and violence. So the science tells us, and indeed our own experience tells us, that when we get hot, we are more likely to be irritable and we're more likely to be physically aggressive. So violence increases. In fact, criminologists have noted for a long time, even if you account for other factors, that as it gets warmer in the summer months, you get more crime because of that kind of thing. And a study by the journal Studies in Conflict and Terrorism concluded that
even if we keep below 1.5 degrees temperature rise, we're still going to see a 14% increase in terrorist attacks simply due to that, to the temperature rise that's come as a result of that. So have you seen that, Richard, when you're operating in hotter places, that basically violence is more on the cards?
Without a doubt. I had the, I would say privilege, but some would say the idiocy of being in Iraq in 2003, and the local community didn't get electricity immediately and therefore didn't have air conditioning. And it was really, really obvious that when the electricity was working and air conditioning was working for them, then the whole sort of tempo of people out on the streets and getting angry, people, you know, protesting or whatever, which is in 2003, which is what I was after the war, is what I was doing, was completely different to when they could go home and keep cool with air conditioning. And it was really, really marked. And there's that great phrase, only mad dogs and Englishmen out in the midday sun. And that was true. I mean, we were the only people and stray dogs out in the midday sun when the air conditioning was working. When the air conditioning wasn't working, there were people out on the streets really angry with us. And so actually keeping the electricity going became a way of reducing the amount of violence that we were likely to see. And you could overplay that, but there was certainly an element of that. And so you can imagine that happening across the world. And the Iraqis, they had air conditioning, they had electricity, they had water, and therefore they could cope with heat. There are parts of the world which very often obviously don't have that, and they won't be able to cope with the sorts of heats that we saw.
So, Richard, that's the kind of the very obvious thing that I think everybody can kind of understand. It's like, you know, it gets hotter, people get more irritable, there's more violence. So that's a very sort of simple direct link. But there's some more systemic stuff, which I know that you've studied a lot, and maybe we could just talk about some of that stuff now. So people talk about climate change being a threat multiplier. This is some of the language I've been learning hanging out with you. What do they mean by that?
So there is the obvious side of the more violence if it's hot. But that is you can sometimes draw a direct link, sometimes not. But it's quite difficult to draw direct links between failing crops, say, and revolution. So the threat multiplier came about really as a way of trying to explain Syria, and it's now considered slightly more mainstream, but at the time it was considered very out there that one of the reasons the Syrian civil war started was because President Assad had suggested that the Syrians should create agriculture outside the cities in much bigger numbers than they had done before, as I understand it, and had provided lots and lots of irrigation to do so, and it was all going swimmingly well until the water dried up. And when the water dried up, not only did the crops fail, but all these people who'd gone out to do agriculture suddenly were dispossessed in terms of their livelihoods, and so moved into the cities and then started getting really angry with the government, President Assad, and then the civil war started, and it was fermented. Now, that's a very, very simplistic view of what happened. But of course, therefore, what was the direct effect? The direct effect was too many people in the cities who were dispossessed. The indirect effect, therefore the threat multiplier, if you like, was the fact that the agriculture failed, and the agriculture failed because the water dried up, and the water dried up because of climate change. And that last link, the water dried up because of climate change, that was sort of more or less a questioned comment for a very long time, although there's been a number of scientific surveys now that have shown that actually, yes, it was. Take another example, a very, very hot summer in Russia, I think it was, and a very, very wet summer in Canada, two of the great bread baskets of the world. They caused a catastrophic failure of harvest, which put the prices of grain up astronomically. And as a result, bread on the front line in North Africa became too expensive, and you got the Arab Spring. Now, of course, the point is, it's not, the Arab Spring, you can't say the Arab Spring was just because of climate change, because actually it was the failure of the harvests, which was down to climate change. And the failure of the harvest pushed the price up, and the price being put up was made bread too expensive, and bread too expensive led to discontent, and discontent led eventually to civil unrest and the Arab Spring. So it's a threat multiplier. It's not very often a direct cause, and it's difficult to prove a direct cause. Now, actually, you can see more obviously there will be direct causes in the future, flooding, rising sea levels. You can see that that is going to cause unbelievable tensions in some areas, drought causing tension. I mean, I don't know whether you heard the news just recently, in fact, about the head of the World Food Programme in Afghanistan talking about a catastrophic failure on the back of 5 years of drought. So climate change will have led to the drought, but the catastrophic failure is because of the lack of aid going into Afghanistan as a result of the Taliban taking over. So it's not drought in itself. For 5 years, there wasn't a massive shortage of food in Afghanistan, and you didn't have the quote this morning, 11 million people potentially suffering from malnutrition. It was the combination of drought plus lack of resources going into the country through the NGOs and other aid as a result of the Taliban taking over in Afghanistan. It's that sort of thing which means that it's a threat multiplier. It is very rarely the direct cause, and that's what we mean by threat multiplier. But if you add enough of those together, you can see that actually there are going to be all sorts of manifestations of, at the very least, unrest and disquiet, if you like, and at the worst, conflict, which will result from the effects of climate change, both the direct and indirect mechanism.
Because if I look at sort of the International Military Council on Climate Change and Security's report from 2021, they talk about this thing saying, you know, COVID has sort of demonstrated how many countries are unprepared to manage multiple crises simultaneously. And what you're saying is if you add climate change into all the other problems we've got, you've got this kind of cauldron of disaster that just makes everything more difficult.
Yeah. I mean, I am absolutely staggered. Between 2014 and 2018, the US spent $400 billion recovering from climate change, the effects of climate change, whether it was flooding or the extraordinary hurricanes. Hurricane Ida had some of the fastest winds the world's ever seen, apparently. That causes immense damage, which then has to be paid for to recover. And the US is a country which can afford to pay for it. But imagine what could have happened to that $400 billion if it wasn't dealing with the aftermath of the damage done by climate change. And so what we're going to see, I think, more and more is that actually more and more is done about adaptation, resilience against climate change, because we know it's coming, which means that that money isn't being spent on other things necessarily. And that will, in my view, it makes it inevitable that it is more likely that you will get civil unrest and so on, because the money that could have been spent on welfare for communities will be spent on building walls against the sea or whatever it happens to be.
I think there's a really interesting point there. Am I allowed to call you Richard? I don't know. I've never.
Of course.
Okay, I've never addressed a lieutenant
general. How dare you? David, that's my general. You call him General Richard, and in my company.
You can call me what you like.
Right. So, Dick, let's.
No. I'll stop there. I don't like Dick.
The serious question I wanted to ask, because I think that's the point, isn't it? It's like I've just been doing a talk today for, it's one of my fascinating, really sexy talks, which was for the Institute of Internal Auditors, Chile branch down in Santiago. And as I was doing the research for it, it's interesting now that internal audit is sort of finally waking up to these massive climatic systemic risks. And they actually now talk about it as a forever risk. You know, one that's not going to go away and one that's going to have to be continually addressed. And I think that point you're making, Richard, about sort of transformative adaptation is really crucial, isn't it? Because it isn't going to go away. When we are going to live through generations of this risk, it's not something that is solved per se, but it is something that is embraced and lived with in rather the same way that we have to do with the pandemic.
I'm a massive optimist. Some would call it foolish, but I'm a massive optimist. But for the entirety of human existence, the last 800,000 years or whatever it is, we've lived with plus or minus 1 degrees. And it has fluctuated. And actually, it was very interesting what David Attenborough was saying at COP, which is about 2,000 years ago. And it is entirely coincidental with sort of sophisticated farming and so on. But about 2,000 years ago, the world stabilized. And with that, and this was something that I met virtually the most marvelous Spanish gentleman called Graminos. I just love his name. Graminos was telling me that the Mediterranean, being a sea that was effectively enclosed, had acted as an extraordinary stabilizer for European and North African agriculture. And that was changing now because it was the second fastest sea that's heating up, or it's heating up second fastest because it's enclosed. But the point was that we had complete stability. We would have to get back to 1 degree in order to regain that stability. And we're going to find it really hard to keep at 1.5 degrees. I heard one of the ministers this morning, and actually I heard John Kerry last week at a dinner I was at, saying that if everything is done which people have pledged at COP this year, all their national determined contributions and everything that India has said about cutting their emissions by 50% by 2030 and so on, that we will get to 1.8 degrees. So we're still nearly double what was a stable world for the last 2,000 years. So you're absolutely right. To get back to a stable world where we don't need to worry about the weather, we've got to take not down to 1.5 degrees. That just stops it getting significantly worse than it is now, but get it down to 1 degree, and we've already passed that.
So, Richard, you started off that very eloquent sort of description of the problem by saying I'm an eternal optimist, and then left me with absolutely no optimism whatsoever by the end of it. Can you bring that back to why you're optimistic, given that quite damning sort of analysis that we're never going to go back to a place without this risk, as Ed was saying, the forever risk?
So the reason I'm an optimist is, funnily enough, it's based on a belief that humans are not stupid. They may be venal, but they're not stupid at times.
Mm. And as a man who's worked, at the highest levels of government, I guess, that's very optimistic for you to say.
So my optimism is based on, if we can find a way through to keep to 1.5 degrees or 1.8 degrees or 1.5 degrees or whatever that is, we will have the wherewithal to be able to get well below that. That's my optimism, that actually we will have cracked the code of stopping the emissions getting larger. We'll have increased the amount of emissions that we're taking out of the atmosphere. The atmosphere will clear itself eventually, although it'll take a very long time, well beyond our lifetimes. But I'm an optimist that actually, if we've cracked the code to reverse the trend, then we will crack the code to reverse the trend all the way down to zero and below. We need to get to below. We need to be taking carbon out of the atmosphere, either through natural sources or through carbon capture, which I'm not massively optimistic about because just a volume of air.
Well, luckily, we have a whole show on that later in the series with the wonderful Dr. Gabriel Walker about how we take carbon out of the atmosphere. But one of the, when you talk about that getting us to a place where we've cracked the code, the job that you were recently given, which is where I came to contact with you, was to work out how to get the Ministry of Defence itself to net zero by 2050. Because a lot of people probably don't know this, but in the UK, 50% of the government's own emissions are from the Ministry of Defence. And actually, that's probably the same in quite a lot of countries. It's actually the government, as an operation, probably the majority of its emissions from any one department will be coming from their militaries. So in order for us as a nation and the government to get to net zero, you have to get your militaries to net zero. And what I find really interesting about that is that that's not a trivial task. I mean, you have things like aircraft carriers and fighter jets. And when other organisations go, it's going to be quite difficult to get to net zero, I always sort of point to your report and go, well, this is how the military are going to do it, so you can stop complaining. But how on earth do you start to think about getting a military to net zero?
Well, there's a whole raft of things. But one is, the first and most important thing is to believe that it's necessary to do so. And I think there are a lot of militaries around the world who cling to this idea that their purpose is to protect their nation, come what may, whatever the cost. And that it doesn't matter how expensive it is in terms of emissions or how expensive it is in terms of cost. If we have to defend our nation, that is what we do. And of course, we have precedent. And I can't remember the exact figure, but it was something like 70% of GDP was slaved to the war effort in the Second World War. Mm. So we've got precedent of just chucking the kitchen sink and everything at the military when it's really necessary. Well, the military's lesson from that The nation's lesson from that is, well, we really don't want to do that again. Thanks very much, because it bankrupted us. The military's lesson from that, I would suggest, is if we need to, we will. And we will chuck the kitchen sink at the military. So therefore, why would we bother with emissions, which are just sort of somebody else's problem, frankly, because we've got to defend the nation? That's the attitude of an awful lot of militaries around the world. It was the attitude, I would suggest, of militaries in Western Europe. It was definitely the attitude of militaries elsewhere that aren't necessarily so governed by democratic processes. And so the first task I think I had to do was actually persuade the military, no, this is your problem. And when I was told, well, we don't need to worry about this, we're exempt. Well, we are exempt from the Environment Bill. We are exempt from, I think it's the Kyoto Protocols that expressly exempted the military. I didn't have a off-pat answer when I was first hit with that. The second time, though, or the later times when I was hit with that and said, so that's great, we're exempt, are we? Are we exempt from the world? Because this is going to happen to us whether we like it or not. The world is changing around us whether we like it or not. And the one thing that militaries really ought to be very good at is understanding their environment, the environment they're operating in, and to be able to flourish in a really difficult environment. That's what militaries try and do. So it was about persuading them that this was something that would affect the military. This was something that would make the military less effective, less good, if you just ignore it. It's not that the world's staying the same and we can stay the same, therefore. It's that the world's changing, dramatically changing, and we need to be alive to that. So that was one part of it. Another part of it was to turn around and say, we own 1% of the UK landmass. We have responsibility for a further 1% of the UK landmass. That's 440,000 hectares. That's a huge amount of land. And therefore, we ought to be using that to increase biodiversity, increase ecology, increase the environmental sustainability of our land. Why? Because that's good land management, actually. And we would want to be custodians of good land management. We actually, this is something that most people don't know, we have more what are called sites of special scientific interest, or special sites of scientific interest, SSIs. We have more SSIs than Natural England. We on MOD land. We have more historic buildings than the National Trust on MOD land. And it's our responsibility to look after them and make sure that they're there for the next generations. And we're under the cosh to make sure that our SSIs are well looked after. So we've got that anyway. So why don't we maximize that? Why don't we use that as an opportunity to sequester as much carbon as we possibly can as part of government, but actually because it's the right thing to do. And it is not that difficult for us to do, because we own the land or have responsibility for the land. And then you come to the sort of simple thing of reducing our emissions. So we've got to be incredibly creative and incredibly imaginative about how to reduce our emissions. And this, I was at a meeting this morning, actually, with our head of ships purchase procurement, a wonderful man called Chris. And Chris was explaining to me that they have now built into every single ship's design an agile approach to the designers have to come up with a reduced carbon footprint. And then through its lifetime, this is the equation they've got to square, through its lifetime, that ship has got to reduce its carbon emissions the whole way through. And it's got to start very low as well. That's been put into the design of our new ships, whether they're the new frigates or the new air defense weapons, ships, destroyers, we call them at the moment, but they may not be the same. We've got to try and reduce our emissions. So we find imaginative ways to do that. And the military are past masters at that. We think innovatively when set a really difficult task. And I think we've set them a really difficult task. I've turned around to the Navy and said, I want all your ships to be net zero from when they leave the dockyard for the very first time in about 10 years' time. In other words, we can't deal with those that we've got at the moment. We can try and do something about the fuel and make it a more sustainable fuel for our fast jets, for our aircraft carriers. But anything that's coming off the production line in the next 10 years must be as close to net zero as we can make it, and improve on that as the ship's life goes on, as opposed to what normally happens is they get dirtier and more difficult and therefore more emissions. That's the target, and that's what we've set the MOD, and that has led to imagination, it's led to innovation, it's led to a really exciting task for the shipbuilders of how do we do this? Let's get behind this and see how we can do. And it's given, in a sense, from the mood this morning, it's given a new lease of life to them. They're trying to do something fundamentally different. They're not just putting a boat in the water anymore and filling it with weapons. They're trying to do something fundamentally different. It's a different enemy, which is called climate change, and they're trying to attack that.
And there's some really practical stuff, isn't there, associated with that as well, though, Richard? I mean, I remember I heard recently a sort of bit of anecdotal evidence from Afghanistan where, you know, I was told by someone fairly senior in the military about some sort of the paradoxes that were going on there, where the army was essentially buying vehicle fuel at like $400 or $500 a barrel when the global oil price was $80 a barrel. And that was down to this overland supply chain from Karachi, which, you know, because of all the vulnerability of those and the security of those fuel supply lines, had meant sort of bribing the Taliban to give it safe passage and then putting that fuel into vehicles to then fight the Taliban, you know, which in what some ways is complete madness, which is gives you a very direct sort of justification for electric vehicles, doesn't it? You know, silent, low heat signature without all of that supply chain and fuel line vulnerability, and, you know, and just to try and square some of those circles.
The approach I've taken is that this is an opportunity. This should be about opportunity, not necessarily all about threat. And whilst it's, and I'm going to be really probably rude, forgive me, but when I listened at COP to both Al Gore and John Kerry, both give a speech at dinners I was at. And Al Gore was, you know, the world's going to hell in a handcart and it's all doom and gloom. And, you know, there's going to be a billion climate change refugees by the end of the century. And we're not going to be able to cope with that number of movements around. And some people have said that climate change is going to affect 3 billion people, that they're going to move and so on and so forth. Al Gore was just like that. John Kerry was, this is an opportunity. This is the opportunity that we've been waiting for to really unleash imagination and innovation in business. And you're right. We had to buy extraordinarily expensive fuel. We then put it into diesel generators. We then, as a gift to the Afghan armies, we left our diesel generators for them, which was genuinely given as a gift, but also it was quite helpful not having to bring them home because that meant more aircraft coming in and out. I was responsible for the withdrawal of NATO from responsible for writing the plan for the withdrawal of NATO from Afghanistan in 2014. And we had anticipated, for example, that 70 to 80% of the UK's equipment would go out by road through Pakistan and to the port and then across to, I think it was Dubai or somewhere, where we were going to clean it all and bio-clean it and then bring it back to the UK. Because they started attacking at the border, the Taliban started attacking all the convoys at the border, we decided in the end that 80% would go by air. So we were quite incentivized to reduce the amount that we were taking out. So we left them our diesel generators. We thought we're doing them a real favor. We taught them how to do it, how to look after them. But the Americans did the same. And funnily enough, their diesel generators are fundamentally different. And by the way, they produced a different amount of different type of electricity, different voltage. And the Germans were doing the same in the north, and the Spanish and the Italians were doing the same in the west. And they were all different generators. So this poor Afghan army was left with at least four, probably 10 different types of generator, trying to get spares for 10 different types of generator and then get fuel to them. And then more importantly, perhaps, get the engineers and mechanics to actually work out how these bloody things worked. If we'd had solar panels, I mean, a solar panel is a solar panel is a solar panel. You know, it doesn't take much maintenance. We could have just left them and they would have had electricity from it rather than generators. So there's a huge amount of support we could have done, reduce our own logistic resupply. And it's a very sad fact that the Americans reckon that 2,000 to 3,000 soldiers were killed on logistic resupply in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's not just about money or about equipment, it's about lives as well. Mm. We lost, the UK lost its most senior officer in Afghanistan, killed on a logistic resupply patrol. He was a lieutenant colonel in the infantry. And so this cost us lives, it cost us money and it cost us equipment, and it was just not the best way of doing business if there's an alternative. Mm. Now, there wasn't necessarily an alternative then, and there certainly wasn't the thinking for an alternative. There is now. It's called renewable energy.
Mm. So I want to just bring you back to the problem. And I think one of the things that you very eloquently state and that we worked on sort of articulating is, I think, the really big one about why we need to fix this problem, which is the relationship between a nation that's caught up in conflict and its ability to deal with climate change. So if we accept that climate change is a threat multiplier, which increases the risk of conflict, your point seems to be that, well, nations in the grip of conflict aren't thinking about their emissions, which means their emissions go. So you get this vicious circle, essentially, where if we don't have peace and security, then we'll never deal with climate change.
So it's a double whammy, Mark, and it's this double whammy which really drives the vicious circle down to the bottom, because not only is it that if you are in conflict, whether it's an internal conflict or a intra-state conflict, then you are doing everything you can to win that conflict, because conflict is expensive, and therefore it's expensive in lives, it's expensive in money, and it's expensive in equipment, and therefore, or blood and treasure, as we call it. Therefore, what you want to try and do is get that conflict over as fast as possible. You minimize your risk by trying to win the conflict as fast as possible. But by so doing, you're completely distracted from, and you're removed from thinking at all about the ecological and environmental effects of that conflict, because at the end of the day, it comes second to winning the conflict. And so you don't think about reducing emissions. You don't think about trying to beat climate change targets and all the rest of it, or meet climate change targets. You're talking about getting the conflict done. And it's an irritant when you have a conflict. You want to just get it over and done with. But then the other thing is that the military who you're using to win that conflict is, in every single case at the moment, a huge emitter. And therefore, you're just massively increasing the amount of emissions. So not only are you not reducing emissions, you're increasing emissions when you're in conflict. So if the world becomes more unstable as a result of climate change, and I would contend, of course, that is exactly what's going to happen for all the reasons we've talked about, then you will end up with more conflict. And if you end up with more conflict, you end up with more emissions. And if you end up with more emissions and not trying to stop emissions, then you end up with more climate change. And so it becomes a vicious cycle. And I would argue there's not a hope in hell of reaching 1.5 degrees if the world has turned into a conflict zone, because we'll all be fighting. And if we're all fighting, we're emitting tons and tons and tons. So we've got to stop that. And we've got to try and therefore reverse the loop and make it a virtuous cycle, which is the more peace there is, the less conflict there is, then it allows the opportunity and the time for people to think about reducing their emissions. At the same time as not using your military, fantastic, which means that they're not emitting. So it becomes a virtuous cycle where you've got more chance of hitting the Paris goals.
Can I ask about the diplomacy side of it? Because we've obviously talked about fundamental shifts. And what I don't want to do is underplay the importance of what we've talked about. If 50% of our government emissions is defence, and we can reduce that by, as you say, using technologies that exist and implementing procedures that we're already working on, that is huge and shouldn't be understated. But there's also a conversation to be had about a fundamental shift being exactly what you're just saying. If we're talking about the role of the military in an increasingly destabilized world, this is a problem of humanity and it needs to be solved together. So to what extent one of the things we've talked about in another podcast is an absence of leadership on this, and politicians by their definition, they are politicized people and they're not necessarily best placed to bring nations together, because they all have certain things they want to achieve. To what extent is there a role for the military in bringing together other militaries, other countries, showing leadership and, you know, the fundamental shift of what you're just saying, that we have to not have conflict to solve this as a globe?
So I think there's two things which give me hope, one of which I was very surprised by and the other of which is an aspiration, so neither of them are particularly firm foundations. What I was surprised by, and I'm going to be very honest, was the Secretary of State for Defence standing up in COP26 and talking about the two sides of the coin, that we have to look after the consequences as well as we're contributing to the problem, and therefore we have to solve that as well. Well, that's great that he said that. But his next comment was not one that was scripted at all, and it's one that he had come to the conclusion. It's one that I was really keen that he said, but I'd never sort of mentioned it to him particularly because I didn't think he'd go there, which is to turn around and say, and therefore we must do everything we can as a nation, as a United Nations, to prevent conflict. Now, that is a very, very fundamental statement when linked to the environment he was in or the context in which he was in, which was about climate change. Because that is turning around and saying that we have a moral responsibility, that's how I would translate it, we have a moral responsibility to try and prevent conflict by going out into the world and trying to build resilience against climate change, trying to rebuild resilience in governance or whatever it is that we need to do. And perhaps using our engineers to build for adaptation and irrigation and all the rest of it in order to try and make sure that we reduce the amount of conflict in the world. Now, you could say, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? But actually, if he puts his money where his mouth is, and I believe this Secretary of State quite possibly will, then we'll see our forces going out into the world where they're invited. We're always a slightly Marmite force because of our history, I suppose. Whereas my father's generation, it was, you know, third of the world or two thirds of the world is pink and aren't we brilliant? Our generation is very much, we need to tread carefully where we've been before. But if we're invited, if we can show that we can be beneficial to countries, both in terms of money and in terms of expertise and planning and in terms of just sheer labor through sending our militaries out there to help them and therefore build resilience against conflict, because this is going to happen to every country that's affected by climate change, I would argue, unless you're incredibly wealthy. That's one side of it. That's the sort of the aspiration, and I'm delighted that the Secretary of State said that, but I'm also confident that actually that will be our role, even if it starts with us doing much more humanitarian assistance and disaster relief as is necessary. The second side of it, which is a much less firm foundation, but I think is an aspiration which I think militaries around the world are beginning to understand, is this coordination between militaries. So we've talked a lot to the Americans about electrifying our land forces, so giving them all electric vehicles and so on. Now, there is no tank, 70-ton Western European or Western Army tank, which is 70 tons, runs for 300 miles across country and can be refueled in 7 minutes, that is susceptible to renewable energy. There is no renewable energy that can do that. So we've got to rethink what that tank looks like. And I would argue you take the people out of it and you can get to a 20-ton tank with the same gun on it. If you want a gun at all, you might have a directed energy weapon instead. But the idea being that it's a semi-autonomous tank, which has taken the people out, it's much safer for the people, but you don't need all the armor because there aren't people there to try and protect. But that's the sort of solution. And that's what we're doing with the Americans and widening that sort of idea around the whole of Europe and then ultimately into Africa and ultimately into South America. And who knows, we might just find common ground with China in the military, which is not seen as controversial or difficult because we're trying to solve the same problem. And I can, with over a million soldiers in their army, the Chinese military will be a huge part of their problem. And they will want to solve it as well if they're going to get to net zero, even if it's by 2060.
So, Richard, one of the things that I think is you have this greening of the military, you have this idea that military is now starting to cooperate on peace, as you say, to reduce the amount of conflict. But also there's this huge kind of cultural signal that goes out when senior military officers like yourself and your colleagues start saying this stuff, when the Secretary of State starts saying it, because people who might have thought, oh, we don't have to take climate change seriously, or it's all, but you know, it's all the purview of those, you know, left-wing tree-hugging environmentalists, they suddenly start to think very differently when, you know, somebody of your rank, you know, in uniform says, we have to sort this out. And when the Secretary of State for Defense, as you say, you know, this week at COP is saying, we have to talk about this and that we have national security and climate change on the agenda at COP. It sort of changes the color of the water, don't you think?
It's very difficult for me to judge that because having always been in the military, it's difficult to judge whether people judge us as having impact or not. But I think there is a piece which turns around and says we're a very difficult part of government to solve in terms of climate change. And if we're prepared to go there, then everybody else should. I think there is an element of that. But, you know, we're under as much scrutiny as any other government department. And I think part of that is to try and make sure that actually this is not just fine words. We've actually got to do something. We've got to demonstrate. And it's interesting, whatever you think about it, I was presented with the sort of national flagship today. Now, the national flagship is otherwise known as the Royal Yacht That Isn't Royal, or whatever the pundits call it today. But I got a message from somebody actually in the cabinet office saying, of course, it is going to be net zero, isn't it? So this would be the first ship that is net zero. And we're designing it now. We've got a few years to build it. It's been the responsibility, or it is the responsibility of the MOD to build it. And that became a major part of the discussion this morning. It was about, you know, how do we make the national flagship net zero? If we can do that, and so it becomes a flagship, a genuine flagship for green solutions, which the MOD has produced, I think that will have an impact around the world. And I think if we make some very, very realistic and symbolic gestures about the next generation of frigates, the next generation of destroyers, the next generation of aircraft are fundamentally different because we've started to think in terms of net zero, I think that will have an impact.
There's an interesting point there, though, isn't there, Richard? I mean, like, I remember back in my early sustainability days, probably about 15 years ago, where I remember hearing someone from the military describing how a Harrier jet was 100% recyclable, as if that was a sort of big selling point for the sustainability of the military. But what you're saying there in terms of sort of net zero frigates and then other sort of types of technology like drones, is it not the case that there could also be a concern that people might use climate efficiency and, you know, material reduction and lower emissions to justify, you know, a more slightly nightmarish Black Mirror type world of unmanned drones and land and sea warfare, which is actually more insidious than the stuff that's directly involving people?
We have, I don't know whether it's a signed protocol, but we have a protocol in this country which is to say that every weapon system will have a human in the kill chain. In other words, we can have drones that do reconnaissance, drones that do some form of intelligence gathering, drones that can be stealthy around the battlefield, the sort of land battlefield. But if a weapon's going to be fired, and I don't necessarily, you know, this is a purely ethical and legal position, which of course therefore can be changed. But at the moment, our view very firmly is if there's a weapon involved in any way, shape or form, a human has to make that decision. A human has to press the button, if you like. And we won't allow any sort of dystopian view of robots taking over the kill chain or any decision to fire a weapon. So that safeguard is there. That safeguard, of course, can be overruled in the future. But then you can have rogue maverick humans who can just not abide by the rules, and you get those occasionally, or you can just have mistakes and you get those occasionally. And so if we keep the rules in place that we have at the moment, I think we're on a path to more efficiency. Funny enough, what I thought you were going to say is that you'd end up with a much, much smaller military. And isn't that a good thing? And I think, you know, actually my favorite statistic, and forgive me because I love this, the crew on HMS Queen Elizabeth, which is our brand new aircraft carrier, stand fast, so don't take into account the air wing, which is different. But the actual crew for our largest ever ship is pretty much identical to the crew of HMS Victory, built in 1770-something or 1760-something. And that says to me that you have two choices. You can either keep your capability the same and reduce the number of people in it, or you can keep the number of people the same and increase your capability massively. You have choices in the military, and therefore, in that way, you can come up with a solution that is not your dystopian, it's all robots, and all robots killing each other, or robots killing robots. It is actually that we have controls in place, and we have choices as to how and where we put people into the system to make sure those choices are ethical.
There's such a complicated clash of language here, isn't there? Because I think, you know, hearing you talk about, I've never, and I think most of our listeners won't have expected this episode on this topic with an army general to have featured talk about biodiversity. And I had an image of you and Chris Packham digging into the soil on a sort of training base. That it's just not where my head has been in terms of where I thought this conversation was going to be. And when you talked about, we talked just then about keeping army numbers large. That again seems to me a clash with what I was expecting, that we should still have a large army. But when you talk about them as a preventative force, almost going around the world and helping to combat climate change, you know, before it has got more severe, there is then still a clash with talk of drones and kill lists and the fundamentals of what we expect an army to do. How much PR do you have to do just in terms of how we discuss what the army is and how we talk to people about an army that, let's be honest, historically is seen by a lot of people as part of an empire, which is, you know, as you say, has caused problems all over the world and is still seen as problematic. And in terms of our recent interventions, they've been in oil-rich countries. That is, again, an issue of PR that there are a lot of people to convince that the military is a force for the future.
It's always a difficult one, isn't it? Because we would like to see ourselves as a force for good. Politicians send us to where we go. If that concept of politicians telling us where to go and we just get on with it is tainted, as I think the Chilcot inquiry suggested that it was, it weakens that argument, but to say the least. But I think there is a piece here which turns around and says your military should be there as a last resort to protect the nation. And that is traditionally what militaries have done. But if you like, if you're not having to protect your nation in a, you know, we haven't fought a war in Western Europe since the 1940s and Bosnia and Kosovo in the 1990s, and they were very, very limited in scope compared to the Second World War. Actually, there is time and opportunity for militaries to do good. But that's why I say, you know, we have to be invited. If we walked into somewhere, there was a fantastic article. Well, it wasn't a particularly brilliant article, but I just thought the title of it was fantastic. About 18 months ago in America, and I can't remember what magazine it was in, but the question, which was, should we invade Brazil to protect the rainforest? Now, for me, that's a fascinating, if you like, philosophical question. To what extent are we going to use our militaries to preserve what is necessary to keep this world a safe place? Mm. And I think that's a really, really interesting philosophical dilemma. Now, the article came to the conclusion of, no, we wouldn't use our military to invade Brazil. We'd use every other means possible to persuade Brazil not to cut down the Amazon rainforest. But it then went on to say, but if the world got so much more desperate, aren't militaries there to protect their nations? And isn't the Amazon rainforest being cut down a threat to the world's nations, and therefore wouldn't you do something about it? So it opens that sort of idea. Now, I think this is a fascinating place. We're nowhere near that at the moment in Western thinking, but I don't think that's necessarily the case in all parts of the world.
I did want to ask about that in terms of, we're maybe not there in terms of our proactive force, but are we there defensively in terms of, you know, we see within this country Extinction Rebellion and talk of civil disobedience. Are you having conversations in the military about the more polluting countries being the victims of attacks that are designed to take out power stations and things, and almost a global attack on the carbon emitting countries by those countries who are suffering the effects of climate change and aren't emitting as much?
It's difficult to put specifics on it. Interestingly, I noticed that in the next couple of weeks, the Army Leadership Center is talking directly to, I think it's the chief executive of Extinction Rebellion, to really try and understand their position. So I think that's a fascinating, you know, we really do want to engage and we do want to understand, even if we don't necessarily agree on the methods, we really do want to engage and understand. But I think it's too early to answer your question directly. I think it's too early to say whether actually there is a sort of global commons about those countries that are most polluting and that we should do something about it. But, you know, there is an inevitable threat to Sudan and to Egypt from Ethiopia building a massive, the Great Renaissance Dam, if they choose to see it as a threat. That, you know, Ethiopia then has control of the waters of the Nile that will then destroy the agriculture of Sudan and Egypt, should Ethiopia wish to do so, and should Egypt and Sudan choose to see it in that light. And this is where we're always taught as military people that you not only need to have capability, but you must have intent as well. And intent to damage in that respect from the Great Ethiopian Dam would be absolutely lethal to the security of that part of the world. But if the Ethiopians were open about the fact, no, all we want from this is a water generator, and we will give you what water you need, and of course there'd have to be negotiation about that, then it diffuses the situation. Until, of course, the water dries up altogether because of climate change, and then Ethiopia's struggling and Egypt and Sudan are struggling, and then the blame game may well start, and you may well get Egypt and Sudan blaming Ethiopia, especially if they hold back water to run their turbines. You can see that something which is arguably really positive in terms of a renewable energy source for Ethiopia, and it desperately needs some sort of renewable energy sources that will provide its electricity and try and build its economy and so on, could be seen as a direct threat by other countries further downstream. And you see that in Kenya. We were shown, I was at a conference where an individual showed the most fantastic farm in Kenya, everything green and lush. And he said, so this is the perfect solution, isn't it? It's all properly irrigated and so on. Until he said, but that farm is attacked every single week because it has taken all the water further downstream, and the people further downstream therefore have no agriculture and therefore attack the farm that is taking all their livelihood, and it looks so beautiful and it's delivering the most perfect crops and all the rest of it, but at the expense of somebody else. And that's the sort of tensions that we're going to see more and more. And that's the sort of tensions we can do something about in explanation, in building resilience, and in trying to build understanding, and more importantly, build a sensible intent, which in the Ethiopian case is don't nick all their water because they'll come after you with guns.
I mean, this, you know, we talk about like, how do we unfuck ourselves? I think we've kind of got onto that now, which is basically what you're saying, a more joined up approach. And, you know, we've talked about what they call the 3D approach, which is not just about sort of defense, it's about diplomacy and it's about development as well. And you've got to have that rounded conversation. And then you bring the military force into that as, you know, something to enact the diplomacy and the development rather than just as a defense force.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And actually, it was interesting that one of the articles I read about the great Ethiopian Renaissance Dam was saying, you know, it doesn't need to be this way. Actually, when water starts to run out, what you need to do is you need to face the dam with a whole load of solar panels so that they get an alternative source of electricity when there isn't enough water, so that they still allow enough water to go down the Nile for Egypt and Sudan and still have enough electricity. So that's about development. And certainly in Somalia, there's real evidence that if you understand the cause of the problem, and the problem in this case was Al-Shabaab recruiting ex-farmers who'd left their farms because they were all completely dry and becoming radicalized and then becoming part of the sort of the Al-Shabaab movement, which was both attacking Kenya and also attacking in Somalia. If you understand the problem, and the problem was there wasn't enough water because it was all dried up because of climate change for the farms, then the solution to the problem is not to kill Al-Shabaab. The solution is to produce water in the farms and to have irrigation systems, which is a complete development system. It's not defense. But the outcome is you have farmers staying because they've now got agriculture that works. That means they're not moving into the cities as displaced persons with nothing to their name, which means that they're ripe pickings for Al-Shabaab. So you reduce the security problem of Al-Shabaab by increasing the development of irrigation. This is nothing new, but it's a very, very visible effect of climate change, and this happens to be in Somalia, of climate change, and how you combat climate change then combats the security elements that might have come from it. So yes, it's all three.
The fact that Al-Shabaab started attacking the irrigation systems because their recruitment was drying up, so even they understood that basically this was an environmental issue from their side as well. I think this sort of, let's get to a happy conclusion, I think, because what's really interesting listening to you talk, Richard, is this kind of, I think, sense of the whole interlinkedness of it all. The way that, you know, I think a lot of people listening to you would probably be quite surprised to hear kind of quite nuanced view of diplomacy and development and the military working together, how you see the world in systems, climate change, you know, affecting conflict and how that all feeds back on itself. And that there is this discussion that's now happened where militaries are getting together. We just had a COP. We had NATO, a whole bunch of other military organisations just talking about national security at a climate change conference. Where do we go from here? I mean, you know, if only there was some kind of, I don't know, international declaration on peace, stability and climate change or something like that. What do you think?
So I think recognising the problem is the most important first step. And I think the UK MOD has definitely done that. And I think a number of other countries have. But recognising the problem and understanding what it means and understanding the conversation that we've had in perhaps slightly more sort of formulaic language in many countries, that would be a fantastic start. And if you can formalise that in terms of a declaration that every single nation stands up to and says, we understand that climate change will lead to a national security issue for us and for our neighbours, and therefore for the world, because we're all neighbours to other to everybody, then actually the reality is, if you had a declaration like that signed, and that's certainly what we're intending to do at the Munich Security Conference in February, is we're intending to get a declaration signed, which acknowledges the problem, acknowledges this vicious cycle that we talked about, acknowledges that militaries have a part to play in reducing emissions, acknowledges that actually we as a security, a peace and stability, a security, a defense diplomacy and development system need to think about this, then I think we could go a very long way to starting to understand how to deal with the problem. And you know, it's a bit like the Churchill quote, this is not the beginning of the end or whatever it is, this is the end of the beginning. You know, if we can get everybody to really think about what it means in security terms, because we've been held back almost at arm's length by the environmental community, which says you don't want to securitize, you don't want to think of everything in terms of security. And I think that's just naive, if I might be so bold, to say that there isn't a security implication. Go back to the very start of our conversation where you know, there's this evidence which suggests that as people get hot, they get more hot under the collar. And what does hot under the collar means? They tend to sort of become more aggressive. If that's a human characteristic, and I say I've seen it in Iraq, then actually the reality is, if you put that onto a global scale, it is going to be a human characteristic that we need to understand, and we need to be able to try and ameliorate and try and do something about as a system of systems and as a group of countries, or as a group of militaries and diplomats and development agencies, then actually we've got some way to go. And some of the arguments that I've had all my career about, is it development first or is it security first? Do you have to have the development which will bring the security, or have to have the security in order to bring the development? And therefore, it's a recipe for never doing anything at all effectively together because we don't trust each other. That's got to go. That's got to go. And what we've got to do is build a partnership which turns around and says, we're all part of the solution or we're all part of the problem. And I think that's where we need to go in the future. And hopefully that declaration, that if we get it signed in February in the Munich Security Conference, that will show us the way that we need to go.
Well, what a fabulous note to end on. And some people would say this was impossible. You know, only a few short years ago, and now it seems like there is this kind of, you say, this talk of a possible new shift in the way we think about security and climate change and development and how they interplay. And to quote Napoleon Bonaparte, impossible is a word to be found only in the dictionary of fools.
Thank you so much for your time, Richard. That was absolutely fascinating. And can I just say from all of us, what a pleasure it is to have you here and to know that you're real, because Mark has been hinting that he's been working with the military for a long time. Frankly, we didn't believe any of it. So to know that you exist and that you know who Mark is a relief to those of us. It was starting to talk like, you know, a man who's got a girlfriend, but she lives in a different village and you're never going to meet her. So I'm glad that we've all been able to be together. Thanks, Richard. Thank you. So there you go, that a fascinating and ranging chat on which I think Ed and I, we would say we were on our best behaviour so as not to ruin Mark's burgeoning relationship. Ed, now you're free to talk. What did you make of all that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that really struck me. I mean, firstly, the way that the general describes all the kind of interconnected systemic failures and how they can build on each other, you know, whether it's extreme weather and climate change or other socioeconomic sort of circumstances, and when they align together and creating these threat multipliers, I mean, I think that's stuff that we talk about a lot, but it was really amazing to hear the sort of general's very integrated perspective on that. I was slightly worried by the description of the British Army as Marmite. That's enough to put sort of you off Marmite for life, because you don't want to be sort of associating your relationship with a kind of yeast spread with an invading force. But also the kind of changing the specification stuff when he was talking about, you know, what a net zero army has to look like. I think that's incredibly powerful, because again, it's one of those recurrent themes, but only the impossible is interesting. And, you know, you can imagine the reactions on people's faces when these type of specs are being written up. But that's the whole point. You know, we've got to do almost the impossible here. And so, you know, unless you're actually stipulating that from the get-go, then we don't have much of a chance. So it's almost reassuring to hear that that stuff's now being written in and we haven't quite got a Scooby about how we're going to do it.
Have we, Mark?
As with the whole show at the moment, you know, of course we can do it. We could have done it before. It's and if we'd invested earlier in these things, it would be cheaper by now. But right now, we do have to pull it out of the bag. The interesting thing I think about the military going net zero and also militaries talking about, you know, international peace agreements because of climate change is the level of investment and attention that gets. So when your military starts saying, we're specking ships this way, they have to be carbon neutral, or we're specking buildings this way, that's a huge knock-on effect on any national economy. And so it's another, you know, it's an interesting lever I would never have expected to have been working with in my battle for the environment. But I think it's huge. And, I know Richard well now, and I'd say we've become friends, so I'm probably slightly biased. But, just listening back to him, I'm just really incredibly impressed by his ability to link all that stuff together and understand his role, you know, which many people would not have thought had anything to do with climate change, and him sort of push that forward in a way that that audience and that organization can hear. You know, it just means that, you know, it doesn't matter where you are, wherever you are, you can be doing the right thing. And even if you're a senior ranking British military officer.
It is, of all the episodes we've done, I think one of those where the content of the conversation is at odds most with the description of who the guest is and what the topic is. I think of all, you sort of usually know.
It's a bit like going to one of your shows, isn't it? Because you're sort of dubbed as a comedian, aren't you?
And then, absolutely.
And then you get there.
Yeah.
And it's almost no comedy at all. It's definitely against expectations.
Why does he keep banging on about the kill chain? I love the stuff about military intervention becoming something, you know, that it just doesn't speak to what most of us would understand. The idea that we'd use our military to help countries install technologies and work in more sustainable ways is fascinating. It brings me on to the subject of interventions and a listener email, which is more of a romantic intervention. Mm-hmm. We've had an email from Jen, mm-hmm. Who, along with a lot of you, I asked what you do when you listen to the show out of genuine curiosity. She says she is listening to the show while embroidering a secondhand cashmere coat with a floral design. Not what I would have guessed, but she gives you some romantic advice, Ed, because we've talked about your sexy voice and the availability of Ed for one-to-one sessions. Shall I put it that way? She says, Ed, if you need to use the podcast as a platform for advertising dating, may I suggest you get a dog? Apparently, you are 14% more likely to meet a partner if you have a dog. So what do you make of that? Maybe, I don't know if there's a community of people who perhaps go to car parks late at night to walk their dogs and sort of just use that as a way to meet each other and have interesting conversations. I don't know what those people would call themselves. But have you thought about that, Ed?
Well, that's also riding on the premise that a 14% uplift would actually deliver success. It depends. If you're starting from a very low bar, it's still quite low probability.
Yeah, and does a sort of dog affect it as well? I mean, if you're wandering around with an Alsatian or like a Labrador or a Chihuahua, do you think that sends some kind of subliminal dating signal? Are there particular dogs that are more successful as a proxy for your romantic desires?
I think the key part is, because I've heard this before and I have seen it in action, people go out with dogs and people come up and talk to them. But I think it's all about the timing of whether or not you have a carrier bag full of shit in your hand at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
I think people will come up to you pre-carrier bag of shit and afterwards they'll probably steer clear.
Right.
But it is interesting. I did want to ask you, because we're having conversations, we have a five-year-old in our house, conversation about getting pets. And I note that both of you are parents, and I don't think any of you have pets. Is that a futures decision? Is it a moral or ethical objection to the ownership of animals? Or is it an allergies thing? And that's today's trivial question. Why don't you have pets, either of you? And have you ever had pets?
I've got some rodents. Do they count? I lifted the lid off the compost bin yesterday to be confronted by an enormous rat, which actually freaked me out, and I literally leapt backwards in the air about 2 feet.
You've got your gay swans, though, haven't you?
I've got my gay swans, and then yesterday morning, I was sat in the kitchen just having a quiet moment with my coffee at the start of the day. A mouse just danced like completely unselfconsciously across the floor, like, you know, almost pausing to say good morning as it went by. And it was like, you cheeky little sod.
I think there's a Disney movie in you, Ed. You've moved to this mill, you know, there's dancing mouse, there's gay swans. I think this could be the Disney movie for the new age.
It really speaks to our different, because I know you've, some weeks I've asked you, Mark, how you are, and you've been a bit down, and we've talked about that, but it speaks to the optimism inherent in you that you heard that and thought Disney movie, and I thought social services intervention. I asked you if you had any pets, and you said, I'll tell you what, we've got rats and mice everywhere in our house. Mark, any animals?
No, definitely not. I had a cat when I was a young boy, but we're definitely not having any in our house. Me and my wife are very, very much aligned on this matter. It's hard enough wrangling children and both being self-employed and it's difficult enough to get anywhere without having to organise, you know, for a pet as well, like if you're going on holidays, you know. So No, I mean, just too much bloody hassle than it's worth, quite frankly.
A concise and passionate answer. I did ask what people do, and Jen there mentioned she was embroidering. Gary from Swindon sent us a lovely email. Always nice to receive emails from Swindon. He listens at work. He sells energy-saving devices, and he's coined himself a term based from this podcast that he calls himself a waste vegan, where he is vegan except for... Now, to me, it means meat that would be destined for the bin, which I literally mean meat on a plate which has been cooked and is about to be scraped into the bin. He widens that out to discounted meat in the supermarket, which he says is destined for landfill. And his intervention is a move to save the planet. What do you make of that?
Well, I see that's where Padre Pete from Bristol has made the lead, hasn't he? He's created a movement by his sort of surreptitious Scotch egg scarfing. And now Gary's taken that and run with it and coined waste veganism. And so,
you heard
it here first, guys. Like, Pete, you know, you've now got the responsibility of a whole movement on your shoulders.
Yeah, and Pete, what you've done is you've managed to turn a podcast, which is all about, you know, saving the future and a lot of it about environmentalism. You've found a new way for people to have an excuse to eat meat. Well done.
Yes. It's basically become the discount meat podcast. It's going to morph into, you know, those guys who turn up and open the back of a van and sell offcuts of meat.
The best one I ever saw of those was not a farmer's market, a sort of car boot sale, an old heliport down the road from here in Suffolk. And there was a guy selling meat out the back of the van doing the old auction thing. And he had a lot, which was pork belly. And he was holding this bit of pork belly aloft, and he said, "Look at that, ladies and gentlemen! It's still got the nipples on it."
And I was "Oh my god!
Is that a selling point?"
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Padre Pete, and you mentioned the confessions, and we've had a convention in from Carolina, who opens her email in a magnificent manner. Good day, always like that as an opener. Lovely level of formality to that. Good day. I love your podcast. End of story.
Where's she from, John? Where's she from?
She doesn't say.
It says her email address is the Czech Republic.
So Czech Republic, wow.
Yeah, we should have a definite Eastern European lilt to this.
Oh, no, I'm not going there. I'll do Swindon, I'll do Northern Ireland, but I'm not going to Czech Republic. Do you want to do it? You haven't got tickets to sell. She says, here is my Christmas confession. You already discussed regifting, but I've put this to another level. I regifted a fruitcake. I hate fruitcake. So, I mean, she knows what she thinks, Carolina.
That's a very controversial view straight off there, isn't it? This close to Christmas, saying you hate fruitcake.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sort of with her in the sense that if someone says cake to me, I don't picture fruitcake. I think it would be fairer to call that like fruit loaf, because there's a joylessness to fruitcake that is not true of a coffee and walnut. Or, you know, an angel cake. Anyway, she says, this blob of candied fruit is not for me. I need sugar. What she did, she used a star cutter to cut the cake into a star shape. Her partner likes cake, so she gave him the offcuts as a gift and then re-iced the star shape and took that to a Christmas party, which is not just re-gifting, but taking two gifts from one thing you've been given. She sort of puts it in as a confession, and I'll put it to you, Ed, to cast your judgment, but she actually isn't really asking for any forgiveness. She sounds quite proud of what she's done.
I was going to say, there's a certain chutzpah to that. I mean, in one sense, it's total genius, isn't it? You know, her boyfriend got all the cake, or got all the kind of offcuts of the cake. Their neighbors got a gift. But I mean, I think that whole re-gifting thing is a little trickier on the food front. I mean, you know, it's some food that I ate half of and then fucked about with. And here's the redressed up leftovers, which I'm now passing off to you as new. And I think there's something slightly dubious about that, Carolina.
Can we not mix this up with Padre Pete and his movement, sort of re-gifting old meat?
Yeah, here's a Scotch egg. I squeezed the egg out through the sausage meat.
Yeah,
because I'm a reformed waste vegan, and so I only ate the egg, so you can have the sausage meat.
What I like about her email is the last line, where she sort of goes to make us feel better about re-gifting and saying, you know, it's an ecological thing to do and all that. It's basically upcycling, she says. But then, just an absolute hammer blow. She says, people don't put so much heart and thought into the gifts in the first place. It's just such a wonderful... And I think there is a truth to
totally
the fact that you do put an emotional weight on gifts. And generally, it is something that they were on their way out of Debenhams and they thought, oh, shit, I haven't got anything for Ed. There's a set of marmalades and I'll just pretend I think he really likes marmalade. She's sort of right, isn't she?
It's far kinder to use your heart and your creative ingenuity and your intelligence to rehash something you've half eaten in the pantry.
I mean, I thought you were going to say you were going to give us all a poem for Christmas, John, Ed.
Or the offcuts of a poem.
Yeah.
Just words that you didn't need that you've taken out.
I did spend today illustrating the cover of my new poetry collection, Mark.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Is there no end to this onslaught? I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take one of your poems. I'm going to cut it up and give you back some bits of it for Christmas.
So I've really enjoyed the emails this week. Have been really fun. We haven't got to all of them, not least because one was so good that Mark said, and I haven't read it, Mark said, we've got to get this guy on. So there's a possibility that if you send in an email or a tweet, it will be so good that we will invite you on the podcast. So if that is not impetus to send in your earthly confessions to be judged by Ed, or just what you're doing while you listen to the podcast, or general feedback or trivial questions, then I don't know what is. And if you're wondering how, and what I really liked, one of the people who emailed in this week, I think it was Gary in Swindon, who said, I enjoy the podcast, but when John tees up how to get in touch with the show, he says, you can email us at hello@johnandthefuturenauts, and he always imagines two at signs and he finds that irritating. So brace yourself, Gary, here it comes. Here's how you can reach us. You can reach us by email at hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. that's hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. We have our own show Twitter account, which is @JandTheF. And of course, you can reach us individually on Twitter too. I am @RonRichardson, John Richardson with the first letter swapped around. That's what I've done there. And you can reach Ed and Mark at the following.
I'm Ed Gillespie @Frucool, which is @FRUCOOL.
And I'm Mark Stevenson, and you can find me @OptimistOnTour.
So there you go. That's this week's show. We will be back next week with another trip down the language map of the world with Ed.
Sorry, I'm just laughing at the fact that you don't remember which episode we're doing at the start of the episode, let alone having the foresight for next week.
That's why I say we'll be back with another episode rather than name the number or the topic. We'll be back with episode 7, which will be the future of... You see, now you don't know, do you? Do we know what it's going to be next week?
Well, we don't know because we could be not any numbers, isn't it? Because we've got all sorts of things lined up.
Yeah, exactly. So I called you on it. Nobody knows. And I don't think anyone knows at the beginning of the podcast what episode it is. I think I just say, what number is this? And you make it up. And because I trust you and I'm a decent person, I say what you tell me to say. And I tell you what, you might be 14% more likely to find a partner with a dog, but questioning the authority of a trusting friend takes you down 28%.
Oh, I'm a negative now then.
But the poetry, well, what do you think, Mark? Do you want to put some figures on the poetry?
Well, all I'm going to say is, I mean, you know, it's a very small sample size, but Ed does write poetry and is single. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you so much for your company, and we will speak to you again next week. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.